those are people in who are now in CNI. Mm-hmm. That I think the people in Ed administration as a body could see the advantages. The people who are in Ed to policy them. Study, but the group that remained felt that we were losing something by having these people be separated. So I guess I can identify it as a group more mm-hmm. than I can as individuals.
Were there any faculty who ended up leaving the university or resigning or anything of that nature because of this breakup?
Not to my knowledge, no. Okay. But nevertheless, this committee on the reorganization set up and the document is prepared that each of the departments, sub-departments within the department would have a chairman, and then there'd be a coordinating committee, the elected chairman of each of the areas, and the departmental chairman would constitute the coordinating committee, with the department chairman serving as chairman of the committee. And so instead of having a faculty meeting, there would be faculty meetings from time to time, but most of the business would be carried on by this coordinating committee. Now this function, this was an experiment, this functioned for a year or two, but it was soon felt that this was not serving. I think they could see Ed Psychology functioning separately and going well, and so this just went to the four winds very quickly, and the Ed administration and each of them, and Dean Stiles, and of course this is always a very important factor. If you've got a dean who is the one that is instrumental in getting the budget, is supportive of the idea of the breaking up into the various segments, you had a tremendous. Now if we'd had a dean at that time who was opposed to the concept, things wouldn't have moved this rapidly.
Was Fox opposed to this?
Fawkes,
yeah.
Preceding. I don't think that it was.
Well, he was on the faculty though at the time.
Yeah, no, he was supporting the idea, I'm sure, for Ed administration, but you see, when the time Fawkes was dean, we were not as large. We were much smaller, and some things has to sort of develop. I think other universities had the same kind of a setup, so having innumerable departments. Well, after all, go back to the early days of universities being set up, the early colleges, there was one department. And then in due time, math set up a separate department and mm-hmm. geography. And so this has been the evolution of the college. Within your, if you are dean of a school and you want it to grow in budget and in faculty so that you can carry on more activities, you'll be going to be supportive of this division, I mm-hmm. think.
I think I'd like to backtrack a little bit to discuss some other points that arose during the time when you were on the department of, or chairman of the department. One thing I'm kind of curious about that I don't really know what its function was exactly was the so-called chairman's advisory committee that functioned. Now I'm not sure if, from what I've been able to find, if that was something that existed while you were chairman.
That's right. That did. That's right.
Now, what is this for?
Well,
it
this
exist
was
now,
set up
as
something to get more input from the various segments of the department, various disciplines within, such as Ed administration, psychology, and the advisory committee was elected by the total faculty to serve. In advising, and I think maybe they advised not only in policy with respect to the administration of the department, but also with respect to some programs to initiate that would come to the faculty then for consideration. The advisory committee, as the name would imply, had no administrative authority, but they did. And the chairman of the department was the chairman of the advisory committee. Do you have the date of when that was established?
Well, that's what I'm not clear about. It does not does not seem to be something that existed, say, back in the late 40s.
Oh, no, no. And it actually was not. When I came here to the department, elected chairman in 55, it was not then. It was towards the end. It was a part of this trying to hold the Department of Education together. It was an attempt by some to meet what might be some of the objections of staying together versus separating.
Was this committee important? That is, I mean, there are advisory committees and then there are advisory committees.
That's right. No, I don't really think they did. I think what evolved eventually within the department was a committee, standing committees, and one was the standing committee on salary and promotions, salary and promotions committee,
mm-hmm.
And this was a committee that was elected by the department that really made recommendations on the promotion of individuals to the executive committee, and the executive committee consists of all tenured faculty, and on salaries. And we were one of the most difficult tasks that a chairman can have, and certainly I was sensitive to that most unpleasant, not only difficult, but unpleasant task, was attempting to develop, to take the criteria that had been established by the department and apply this to the individual, saying this individual, in the judgment of the committee, and we would attempt to quantitate it by putting X weight on each of the factors. This individual in the department should get the maximum raise, this one should be something less, and this one something less, and something less. And so often a departmental chairman is asked to do this, but I, in the early 1960s, and difficult to after all, no one individual could be knowledgeable in all the disciplines represented by the Department of Education. So by establishing this committee on salary and promotions, you had people represented there who had more or less representing all the areas that could make a better interpretation as a group. What we did...
Was this to avoid the kind of thing that went on with Clarence Ragsdale earlier?
Yes, yeah, right. Yeah, it was an attempt to, initially, of course, the decision was made pre-arbitrarily by the chairman and brought to the department, or it may be in a small committee, as I recall, that would work with the chairman and would come in. And we had some very horrible situation in the early days of time for salary adjustments, a sheet being handed out and all the members of the department listed there, and this person no raise, this person maximum, and the person wouldn't know anything about it until he receives it for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was
I've seen them.
Very inhumane, if nothing else, way of handling a very, very sensitive matter. So this committee, salary and promotion, which was elected by I think there were for 3-year term, but rotating in such a way, overlapping, so that two or three were coming on new each year, and there had to be representation from the full professors, associate professor, and the assistant professors. But we would spend many, many, many hours going over the reports submitted, professional reports submitted by faculty members, and attempting to make evaluations. And each one on the committee would make an evaluation, then we'd combine those, and then in a joint session, I mean, with all the committee members, here's the way it averaged up. Here are the votes of individuals. And then from the discussion, sometimes evaluations were changed. So it was first done individually by each committee member, then through mm-hmm. a cooperative effort. But I'm convinced that in departments that merited in size, this is by far the best way to approach the very sensitive matter of trying to make evaluation of merit, and which is necessary on a university program. This has been an eternal problem, of course, in education as to whether salary should be based upon merit, or should it be based upon some sort of a step program?
Okay. Today is what, February 13th. And we're trying today to complete some things you have to say about the School of Education chairmanship or Department of Education chairmanships. We were just talking about these different examinations that the School of Education had, especially for people are interested in getting doctoral degrees, and one in particular piqued my curiosity was this critical thinking examination. Could you discuss that?
Yes, I think the critical thinking exam was developed with the idea that this would be one method, one procedure of identifying those people who could write more effectively and perhaps would have the potential to do the necessary reporting in a dissertation of research that they would carry on for their PhD degree. So the critical, there was a concern, I'm sure, by faculty members that many of our candidates would be able to complete the coursework, but when they come to writing their dissertation would fall short for their inability just to do that kind of thing, that kind of reporting, or to handle data and analyze it. And so the critical thinking so-called test was to give the candidate X number of issues that existed. Faculty members would supply from the various disciplines within the School of Education. And the candidate, it seems to me that was a four-hour exam. I don't recall precisely the length, but it seems to me it was a four-hour exam on critical thinking. And they would take one issue. I believe, as I recall now, maybe there were two issues, so one written in the morning and one in the afternoon. And perhaps one of a more general nature and then an issue more specifically related to their own field of study. And then develop a rationale, pros and cons for the issue, and write to it. It wasn't necessarily one that would call upon a great deal of knowledge or a great deal of reference to individuals who may have contributed to that, but one of just a how well the person himself could write his thoughts on the pros and cons of the subject. And the critical thinking invited this pro and con of the issue, not just to take one side, but to take both sides. And that was carried on for some years, and apparently, eventually it was dropped as a critical thinking, but to my knowledge, the writing exam still is continued in some sort or some form as a part of admission to the doctoral program, at least in CNI, as I recall, the last experience I had. I guess we ceased calling it a critical thinking exam, and now more or less of a writing exam.
Well, they have, at that time, they had the critical thinking exam. I do believe, though, they still had, in addition, at a later point, the preliminary exam. There's a critical thinking was an examination that came along with this a master's comprehensive examination that was given. That is, that there was a very specific low-level examination given after the first year or so of graduate school, and this was part of that.
But it wasn't as a part of the procedures for admission to the doctoral program.
No, this is part of the procedure for admission to second year of graduate work, which was done independently, so to speak.
Well, that is usually the point, admission to the doctoral program, you see, that I'm referring to.
See,
there are two steps. You're first admitted to the graduate school, And then subsequently, usually after at least a semester, perhaps a year, the person may make application to the doctoral program, but the mere fact he's admitted to the graduate school and taking graduate work does not mean, of course, he's admitted to the doctoral program. So there's a formal step there, that admission to the, sometimes it's called admission to candidacy for the PhD degree. Mm-hmm. And at that time then, the committees who are delegated for that responsibility rule that the candidate, and these are recommended really to the general faculty. Now, the general faculty, all the data collected on the individual who is applying for admission to the doctoral program after, and no one is ever admitted until they've completed some work on our campus, at least as far as my experience is concerned, that I recall a person never being. It's always after completing. So you've got the record of what the person has done here. You have the certain tests that he must take, and the writing exam, which may be this critical thinking or something else. But it tells the committee of three, usually the committee of three in the graduate exam committee that makes the evaluation, makes a recommendation to the committee, and then the committee makes a recommendation to the total faculty. And they usually have the candidate identified by number, so it is not known who the individual is. And then a tabulation of the various scores made on the tests, grade point average, undergraduate and graduate, etc. And at that time, it's sort of automatic business. If somebody wants to raise a question, it may be taken out of automatic and put in the regular agenda so that official action can be taken. But if there are no questions, and frequently there are none, then the report of the committee is accepted and goes to the graduate school, and the person becomes duly admitted. Now, that's the general procedure that was developed some years ago.
Now, when you were chairman and you were involved in this in detail, were there changes made in the sort of weighting that was given to various sorts of indices of accomplishment while you were there? That is, I know that, for instance, in the art department, that the way graduate students are evaluated for admission and later on is different now than it was, say, 15 or 20 years ago. Has there been some change in the way that's been conducted in the other departments that you're aware of?
No, not really. The basic structure, I think we have to realize in the final analysis, the evaluation is made by the committee that's in existence at the time. Mm-hmm. Individuals don't always look at these criteria in the same way or give the same weighting. I was never aware of the fact that 20% for this factor and 10% for this and so forth, that it was sort of a total evaluation of these. If one might conceivably be weak in one area and strong in another, these would be offsetting each other. There is one factor that did exist up through the time that I was chairman, namely, all PhD candidates must have 2 years of actual teaching experience. Mm-hmm. And someplace along the way, a road since that period, that requirement has been dropped. Mm-hmm. There was a period back there many years ago when...
Even in CNI that's been dropped?
I think so. At least it's frequently waived, and now we have people, you know, continuing on, doing their undergraduate, then going right on, continuing graduate work, and particularly, I think, in departments like Ed Psychology and some of the other. Now, CNI, I think the requirement is frequently waived, and again, it may depend a great deal upon individual advisors. Mm-hmm. I don't recall that I have ever, in my experience, had a person I know, excepting the very last one who still hasn't completed his degree, I never had a PhD candidate who did not have some background of practical, actual school teaching experience. And as I say, the last one never finished, so I guess I can make that generalization. But I do know that that is not, in my recent years of experience, was not adhered to so strictly as it was one time. There was another requirement one time, and that all students had to take 6 credits in the history of education or courses related to that.
Mm-hmm.
Has that ever been mentioned in any of your discussion? But Borrowman, when he came, I don't know, this was established back some years even before Borrowman arrived on the scene. And this was carried on for many, many years. All students had to take 6 credits in the area of history of education, philosophy of education in that bank. And that then in due time was dropped, as was the school, the university had a requirement here for many years that all students to graduate from university had to have 1 course in American history.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in due time dropped. So there has been certainly in recent years, the last 10, 15 years, a lessening of the specific requirements and permitting more flexibility. Even the language requirement for the PhD degree, I felt for my many, many years here that that could never be dropped, because there are so many professors in the academic fields particularly who felt strongly that this was a requirement should remain forever and ever. But it did break down, went very rapidly, as a matter of fact. And people completing PhD degrees today, in the last, 10 years perhaps, it's ceased to exist. I think it was long delayed, but our people met the requirement, and it was just a hurdle to get over. It really, of course, originally it served a useful purpose, but in recent years it was just a hurdle, nothing but that. Well, perhaps that's sufficient to point of the exams.
Okay. One other thing we were talking about was this matter of, during the time when you were chairman of the department, a number of joint committees were established with education and philosophy, sociology, and psychology. And one thing that I'm not really aware of is the fact that whatever became of these committees or what was their purpose. But
well, they were established with the primarily between two areas in the school, in the Department of Education, namely ed psychology, and the other was philosophy and sociology, now known as what is that area?
Educational policy.
Policy studies, yes. Well, now, those were established by the faculty in Department of Education with the idea of promoting greater cooperation and support from these academic areas. And I think there was pretty much the initiative of our faculty, and they were organized, and they met. I think there were some attempts to eliminate what might exist in the way of duplication. And they died a natural death in a few years because of people in the psychology department busy with their own affairs and people in philosophy department. And so it may have had a useful purpose initially, and particularly at the time that Ed Psychology established their own department. You see, that mm-hmm. was subsequent to this 1957 date.
Now, one thing we've been discussing was the matter of the relationship of L&S and education, the schools, and the apparent decline in their interaction. Is it possible that part of that decline is somehow related to the degree of cooperation that usually went on through these various committees? That is...
Yeah, I think so. I think that is the decline in interest of the committee might have been a factor, or paralleled this total lack of mm-hmm. interest. For example, I had one thought as we were visiting about the divisional committee. You recall that sometime about this 1956-57, under the urging of the then Dean Stiles, we applied for admission to the Social Studies Divisional Committee,
right,
and to become a part of it. Now, prior to that time, any work within the School of Education and screening people, or ruling, or taking action on people who were applying for tenure was done by a committee established by the dean, people from LNS as well as from education. And when the primary function of that committee, namely reviewing tenure cases, was now done by the divisional committee, this may have been one factor that caused this lessening of the inner working and the involvement, because prior to the divisional committee, there was a real need for the people working on the dean's administrative committee to assume a responsibility for tenure appointment. But it still was more under the control of education than a divisional committee would be, of course.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. So that there's a structural aspect, you're saying, to this, and we also talked earlier about sort of a generational problem, that the people in LNS who are really interested in education,
that's
at
right,
this time were beginning to leave the faculty.
That's right. I think the both those factors contributed to this decline in the cooperative efforts, without any specific action by either group being taken, saying, you know, as far as the laws and rules and regulations are concerned, I guess, as you pointed out earlier, what existed when the School of Education was originally established still exists. That is, that any person who in LNS teaching courses that a prospective teacher might take has a right to come to the School of Education faculty meeting and vote the same as any budgeted person.
Mm-hmm.
But rarely do they take advantage of that opportunity anymore.
Now, something related to this divisional committee, at least I think it might be, was that I came across something in the minutes in 1958. Dean Stiles came to your faculty meeting and said, "We're getting too many Wisconsin graduates promoted to tenure." Was this somehow an interaction between divisional committee, or was this a new problem? I don't know if you remember that, but I thought that was rather unusual that the dean would stand up and say something that specific at a faculty meeting.
Yeah, I think there was a concern at that time that there were many of the faculty. This was a great period of expansion, of course, and there were people being appointed who had done their graduate work here, and this has always been a concern, the interbreeding or the inbreeding of a department, of employing too many of the people who had done their graduate work within the department. And I think this is one of the observations that Dean Stiles had made, and it wasn't to close a door on all people who had done their graduate work here, but it was trying to get a better balance. And I think my point in history when this was a policy being a great concern by many universities, the inbreeding, and to minimize this. I'm sure it's this factor is one that's foremost in the minds of people today. You know, your chances, if you get a degree at the University of Wisconsin, being employed here, are surely not as great as if you had the same criterion, same requirement, I mean, same preparation coming from another institution.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it helps if the person has completed his degree, had gone elsewhere, and been there for X period of time, and then comes back.
Okay. I think that about takes care of that. There was one other problem that came up that seemed to occupy a bit of your time during that period, and that was the matter of what to do about people were working in extension education, what their rank in the faculty was, and so on and so forth. This seemed to cause rather a commotion. Can you elaborate about what that was about?
Well, there's always been concern on the faculty, generally speaking, at the university. The School of Education faculty members who have a full their salary for daytime teaching, and then get teach extension courses as an overload and get extra compensation for it. And then back in the days when salaries were low and the School of Education faculty could take these overloads and receive it, was irritation across the faculty, across the campus. And so evolving during the period that I was chairman and continuing on was a honest desire to minimize, reduce the number of faculty who were teaching full-time and getting a full salary on campus and then teaching for extra compensation, an extension class. And so there's an attempt to put this as a part of the fact that the university, the person who would be teaching an extension course, that would be part of his load. Well, of course, the motivation for driving to Wausau or someplace else is greatly reduced when you don't get any extra compensation beyond that which you would get if you were teaching the full load on campus. And so this is a problem that evolved of getting people who would be interested. And for students to take extension work and to get graduate credit, there was a very strong feeling that it should be not ad hoc faculty, but regular faculty, campus faculty who would go there. So if you don't offer certain incentives for these people, obviously it's hard to meet that requirement. So on the one hand, you're saying it must be regular faculty and not ad hoc, that is some superintendent or principal, someone who might be qualified, but would not be a regular university professor teaching the course. And the graduate school was very, very much concerned. And one of the requirements would be to send this list of people who would be teaching out in extension and have it approved by the graduate school. Now, if it would be a regular faculty member, there'd be no question. But if it would be someone other than a regular faculty member, then the graduate school required that substantial evidence be presented to show that this person was well qualified to handle the graduate course.
Well, if not a regular faculty member, then who? I mean,
well, might be a faculty member from another institution, mm-hmm. one of the state colleges, for example. It might be someone who got a PhD degree here, a superintendent of schools, for example. It might be someone who was in the Department of Public Instruction with a PhD degree and be qualified. Now, these are individuals that might be considered in the ad hoc positions in extension. But this, I don't know. I know that some people were employed to be joint extension in education, and of course they were employed with the idea that half of their or X percentage of their load and salary would be teaching courses off campus. So that was one way of solving this problem of providing people who would be regular faculty members on the one hand, and on the other hand would be available to go out into the countryside. Now, of course, with graduate work being offered by all the other campuses, Whitewater, Eau Claire, etc. This is a little different problem of staff being available, because they are, as a matter of fact, now, as you may know, the territory has been established, and if you're at Whitewater, you may not go certain places. If you're at Madison, you may not go certain places, and during the time I was chairman of the department, many years thereafter, we were the only institution in the state offering graduate work, so there was no conflict at that time with any other institution. Mm-hmm.
A long time ago, when we first got together, you mentioned something about, at the time that you became chairman, there was a bit of a conflict over elementary education between the so-called Pella group, as you mentioned, and the Herricks group. and you never elaborate on that. Can you do that?
Yeah, I think if I were to testify as to the position or the factor or the element that might have contributed to the success that I may have had as chairman of the department, was that I attempted and had considerable success in bringing factions together and working together. And in the elementary education department particularly, it was a new department. It was primarily personality conflicts, but Herrick and Pell had been brought in from outside, people with good backgrounds and fine reputations, Herrick particularly. And Pell had been here, and Sarah Rue had been employed to work in the elementary department. And Milt was in the field of course, science education, but that also involved the science education for prospective elementary teachers. So this is where he got involved in the elementary program. So John Mayer was chairman of the department preceding me. Now, the year preceding was Peterson, but Mayer had been chairman for some years, and he was in math education, and he became the acting dean when Faust left. And so I think John was an excellent department. I think he may have cultivated a little bit the separation by the fact that he had animosities, or there were periods of confrontation between Mayer as chairman of the department and Herrick and Everman, and so it got so that as they didn't work as a group, and they would bring their individual tales to the chairman of the department, and the chairman of the department would work with them individually rather than as a group, and it got, and this was carried on very much apparently in the Peterson administration. So when I came aboard in fall of 55, the first thing I did was to call the group together in elementary education and say that this is a field that I have no background in, and you people are the experts in the area. It's absolutely imperative that you work together, and I'm calling this first meeting, and I'm inviting you to elect some person who will become the chairman of this group, and I can work with the chairman, and we're all in this for the same purpose. So we were able to establish an unofficial committee. It was an official committee, but I mean it did not have departmental status.
Mm-hmm.
And that's carried on, I guess, even today. The elementary ed division has a chairman, but it is not like a departmental chairman, but it does that. The chairman of the department works with that chairman.
Mm-hmm.
So I recall Virg Herrick coming in one day, my very first few months that I was in the departmental office, wanting some work done. And Helen O'Connell, the secretary at that time, the chief secretary, was saying something to Professor Herrick that we didn't have time, et cetera, et cetera. So I chatted with him a little bit, and I said, well, my position, the chairman of the department, is that we're in here to work with the faculty, and we will do what we can, Verge, to provide you with that help. And I remember Verge saying later, that's the first time he ever had a positive reaction to that department. That this had carried over to the clerical help too.
Mm-hmm.
That there was an animosity to heck with certain faculty members. So things moved along much smoother and better as a result, I think, of my having been able to get these groups together. Now, I'm not aware of the same kind of factions developing in other areas, but obviously we did try to establish a good working relationship, and one thing I did attempt to do is to be sure that I didn't have favorites. We treated them all alike, and apparently I had some degree of success. At least people were perfectly willing for me to stay on. Mm-hmm. I stayed 1 year more than I ever intended to, but I guess that's about the end of that story, really.
One last question on that. Was the animosity that you described based mainly on just had some troubles personally between people, or was it a matter of some issue or something concerning the program?
I think it was primarily personality conflicts rather than program. Now, there's no doubt there were some points that of emphasis that some Herrick may have been trying to develop some points and some emphasis that were in conflict with what some of the others may have felt. But I would say in general, those things sort of faded away once there was a working relationship established. And incidentally, Paul Eberman recently passed away from lung cancer. He left here and went to Temple University. He was an assistant dean there for many years. And he's still young. He still was young.
Okay. You were going to discuss about the specialist degree that apparently was never established, but would have been an interesting change.
There's a strong feeling here and across the country in the developing perhaps in the early 1960s that particularly for school people who are involved in teaching or involved in various positions in connection with schoolwork, there should be an intermediate degree between the master's and the PhD, and that many of the school boards had set up salary schedules that gave recognition for 30 hours of work beyond the master's. That would be a step in the salary schedule.
Right.
And many people took these 30 hours, and they were a hit and miss. They just often no organized program. And so there was a feeling that having a specialist degree, which would be about 30 hours of work, about a year's work between the master's and the PhD, that would attract many, many people who would not be interested in the PhD, might not even have the necessary background or competencies to pursue a PhD degree, but still would be better than this haphazard kind of meeting the 30-hour requirement that school boards had universally established. And by the way, those were established in cooperation with teachers. I don't think the school boards themselves evolved the idea. It was probably presented to them by faculty. And so not only here in Wisconsin, but Michigan State and many other schools had established this intermediate degree called specialist. And we here in CNI, now this was early 60s, mid 60s, started working on a program that would be a cooperative program between subject matter areas and the Department of Education or other departments, and then with CNI, within the School of Education. And so I had been for some years on the administrative committee of the graduate school, and I had presented the idea to the administrative committee of the graduate school in an informal way, and then received encouragement. And so within the CNI, Professor Hutchins and particularly, forgotten all the people involved in it, Hutchins and myself were the two that sort of were, Hutchins the chairman of the department of CNI at the time, and I was the liaison because I was on the administrative committee, were the two who were the spokesmen for the program. But we developed the program in cooperation with subject matter people like Pell and others who were in social studies education. Petzold, I recall, in music education was involved. And so we developed the program that was 30 credits beyond a master's degree. It was to be considered primarily a terminal degree, not as an intermediate step to the PhD. And serving primarily school people, those who were on salary schedules, who might, we were hopeful that this degree would be recognized by school people as meeting the 30-hour requirement rather than just any 30-hour collection. So we got the program approved established, and by the way, it was in cooperation with the idea 50% of the work would be taken in the academic departments, and this was one factor that the graduate school felt strongly about, that this should not be all professional education, that the degree ought to contain a substantial amount of courses in the subject area of the prospective degree candidate. And so we developed the program that way, and it was approved by the department, the School of Education. It went to the Ministry Committee of the Graduate School, and it was approved there. It went to the Board of Regents. Now remember, this was before the merger with the other campuses. And it was approved by the Board of Regents. And it was all ready to go, but it had to go to the CCHE. This is a committee, coordinating committee on higher education, been established. That was sort of up here. It had no, it didn't handle budgets, but it had the veto power of killing programs. It was the idea of coordinating, as the name suggests. Well, when we took the program to the coordinating committee, they vetoed it because apparently there had been some understanding on this committee, on the coordinating committee, CCHE, there were people from the state colleges, and they were anxious, obviously, to develop the graduate programs in these state colleges. And there was a concern by the university people that the state colleges should not become PhD institutions. Mm-hmm. And so there was a willingness by people in the university to say, okay, we'll let them have this crumb and let them have that requirement with the understanding they will not develop a PhD program. Well, I thought it was tragic and unfortunate because these state universities had only recently started graduate work, and now suddenly they have the opportunity to give specialist degrees beyond beyond the master's, and they're only recently involved in that work, whereas the facilities of the university and the faculties would obviously make this institution much better qualified. But politics being what they were, and the issue had been raised several times, and after this was vetoed in 1968, that's the 1969 summer session, that's when it went to the CCHE and was disapproved, because of for the reasons I've stated. And I, several times after that, attempted to get interest, but every time we did, it would go to administration. They say, leave it alone, we cannot, because we don't want those institutions getting involved. They didn't say this so expressly. We don't want those institutions getting involved in PhD where we want to hold that, so we're not going to be out and competing with them with a specialist degree. So for this is a primary concern to the School of Education, because it is that group, teachers, who would be most concerned and interested in the specialist degree. Mm-hmm. The academic areas were not interested because they have a PhD program, and in many of the academic areas, when a person starts graduate work, it's the idea that he's pursuing for a PhD. The terminal degree, a master's degree in the academic area, is very limited compared to School of Education. And a specialist degree there is something in between. As a matter of fact, some of the academic areas now, when a person gets a year beyond the master's and he's officially admitted to candidacy, there's some sort of a certificate the graduate school, I think, has developed in recent years will give that person. He just has, it's short of his prelims, you see. Well, it may be after the prelims, but before he doesn't go beyond the prelims. I think that's where the graduate school will give some type of paper that will indicate that level of achievement. So, as far as I'm concerned, one of my greatest disappointments in my entire professional career at the University of Wisconsin was getting the specialist degree all established and feeling so enthusiastic about it and the potential it would serve. I felt here all these other campuses now are offering graduate work at the master's level. This is where we in the School of Education and my own field in business education could perform a unique service. But we were denied that by CCHE, and after CCHE ceased to exist and we got the merger, the same policy has continued to this day. So that's a sad story.
Okay.
Sad to me, at least.
Yeah. There's one other... a little point, I know it was a little, but sort of a off the beaten path sort of point or question I wanted to ask. Came across some correspondence from 1971 concerning your stag parties.
Yeah,
you
are, okay.
You
yeah.
were well known in the school for having an annual stag party, although I believe it wasn't exactly along the same line as one classically thinks of those.
No. Well, during the period I was chairman of the Department of Education, I got an interest in building and did build a cottage. And Bert Kreitlow, I had been up, my family had visited Bert Kreitlow in the summer of 1957. This is during midpoint of my term as chairman, and I got the idea and the interest to have a place on the lake, and I came back and found a lot very luckily out in McFarland on Lake Wabisa and built a cottage in the fall of 57 and the winter of 58, and that spring we had it all completed. So I thought, well, it'd be nice, I'm chairman of the department, I'll invite the fellows out for a little stag party. And so we had cards and beer and had food brought in, and it was this kind of a get-together. And we didn't have women, I guess, for two reasons. One, there were very few women, I guess only one or two, in the Department of Education at that time. Never occurred to me that they would be interested, I guess. So we continued this for many years. I, being also a member of the school business faculty, had the men in the school of business out in the fall. So we had, and for the first few years, we had our food catered in. But then later, we started cooking our own hamburgers and beans, and I developed quite a reputation with my baked beans, hamburgers, etc. And it was always a lot of fun. We'd start late afternoon around 4 o'clock and play some cards and drink beer and have food and conversation. And well, out of the blue, down the road to some place around maybe as late as 1970. See, I first one was 58, and it's carried on every year. It's each year. I don't know. I guess before it terminated in my retired, we'd had something like 17 or 18 in the sequence. And of course, I might say that this was not only for faculty. I had my student groups out in the spring. I had all my students, undergraduate students. During the during the summer session, I would have at least two groups of faculty of graduate students out. So it was a wonderful place to entertain. And 1964, we moved the cottage off and built a year-round home there, and the facility then was even much better for entertaining stag parties or whatever. Well, as I say, sometime around 1970, there was a this movement of greater involvement of women and equal rights and faculty members, the women faculty members in the affairs of the university. And I was not sensitive to any concern by anyone, but what was it, Anne Roberts? No.
Joan Roberts.
Joan Roberts was in the Ed Policy Study Department. And she apparently was a leader that had discovered this party was going on, and it was not sponsored in the university in any way, excepting I did apparently use the university mails to announce it to the faculty. And so I was completely unaware of this till one day I got a call from the chancellor, Ed Young, and he said, Russ, what's the stag party you have out at your place on Lake Wabeson? I told him a little bit about it. And he said, well, you know, the women are protesting this. And well, I was completely flabbergasted, really. I hadn't conceived that women would be concerned. And so I said, well, I'll just cancel the party, which I did with university mail. Then I sent out a personal invitation, U.S. mail, my own expense, and invited the faculty to men faculty. So we continue having it, but I thought as long as I'm doing it myself and not utilizing university facilities, there'd be no claim. But Joan Roberts did protest in the letter, and I recall I had a letter from now Mrs. Glenn I to say that she was Lenore Netzer. While she was one to feel that women had their rights and she was a strong spokesman, she felt in this case that Joan Roberts and other women who were interested in coming to the to our stag party, so-called, were out of line, and she did not support that movement at all. So we continue having the party, but I just stopped using the university facilities to announce it. That's about the end of that story. I must say that that during the period of 1958 through my retirement in 76, there must have been thousands of people who came. We would have an institute, Business Education Institute, every mm-hmm. summer, and as a part of that would be an outing on Thursday night. The institute was usually all day Thursday and Friday. And Thursday evening, we would. This has been in more recent years, not beginning in 58, but more recent years. They would come after this, after we built the place in 64. We'd have them out there to the for a cookout. I recall we had up to 150 people that we'd cook hamburgers and beans. But the interesting thing, I should be a matter of record. I had this. This affair for the faculty in education, the faculty in business, my graduate students, the institute people, the undergraduate people. At least four or five a year for all these years, and never once were we rained out. And I had an unbelievable record. You just can't conceive of the summertime when there are storms developing, you know. And so I developed a tremendous reputation as one who could select days when we'd have no rain, but never once. And this I'm glad we didn't let this slip by, too, as a matter of record, that I had control with the weatherman. I mean contact with the weatherman. Mm-hmm. So it is interesting when you stop to think of it, that you know, you plan a party months and months ahead at a certain time, and it would have been a mess too, because we had to cook our hamburgers outside, and we did have plan B to go someplace and cook it, but it would have been very inconvenient. Mm-hmm. Well, that's the end of that story, I guess.
I think all we have left now are just various tidbits as I wish to pull them out, I guess. One thing I was you might be able to talk to is if you could explain, if there's anything to explain about any of your working relationships with the Department of Public Instruction, especially considering your particular field probably brought you into a little bit closer tie with them than a lot of the other faculty. Can you discuss that?
Yes, I would like to, as a matter of fact. I was on a committee of the National Business Education Association that was involved in attempting to get business education as a part of the 1963 Vocational Education Act, and we were able to get business education identified as in that act. Now, the framers of the act had in mind that this was to support all vocational education, but the fact that business education had never been supported before, it was in the minds of many people not included. So there was question. We felt that it was very important that business education be expressly included, as well as the other programs like ag and home economics had been previously. So when this act was approved with business education expressly stated, I came back and Rothwell was then the Department of Superintendent of Public Instruction, Agnes Rothwell. So I went to Agnes. I said, "What do you know about this new vocational education act?" And he said, "Well, I don't know anything about it." So I was able to provide him that it was just coming available, and that there'd be a great deal more money. And prior to this, all the federal funds were going to the vocational board under the Smith-Hughes Act and the George Dean and George Barton, as was established. But in all other states, the vocational board was a part of the Department of Public Instruction. But as all people in Wisconsin, educators in Wisconsin know or should know, since 1911, Wisconsin, we've had the dual system. So these monies were going to the vocational board, and the vocational board are using it entirely for the post-secondary or the vocational schools. And the only thing was going to the high schools were the monies to support ag in the schools and home economics. But there was nothing in for DE, distributive education. There was nothing for industrial education. Those were being used only for the post-secondary. So when I mentioned this to Superintendent Rothwell, that this new act would make a great deal more money, and it was intended for high school and post-secondary, he then and Clarence Greiber started working together and evolved a plan whereby this money would continue, of course, going to the vocational board, that by law had to, but then they transferred X amount, initially I think it was 33%, back to the Department of Public Instruction so that they could establish personnel in the Department of Public Instruction to work with the secondary. And my first step in this involvement was to recommend one of my students who had recently completed his master and was doing work on his PhD, and he had done his undergraduate work, Bob Ristall, who had a very fine background of experience both in schools and currently was personnel manager before in the insurance companies here in Madison. And so of course there were many other people nominated, and Bob was selected to head up the program in vocational education in BPI, and he established then a supervisor in business education, one in all the other. Well, I should back up. The supervisors that had been going out to the high schools were from vocational board. And so when the DPI established this program, it was felt, and that was always an awkward situation too. Here, DPI here on the one hand going out doing certain supervisory work, and then here were individuals coming from the vocational board going to the high school. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they didn't communicate too well. There were conflicts of one kind or another. So eventually, these supervisors then were transferred back to DPI under in the department I developed manpower. I've forgotten just what the precise name, but it was certainly included all the vocational disciplines. And Bob Ristall served in that capacity for some years. And he then left to, he's now at Eastern Michigan University as chairman of the department in that program. And one of the persons in charge of business education under Bob was Rule Falk. And when Bob then left DPI, Rule was appointed through normal procedures as director of that program. So I've had a very close working relationship, and it's interesting that all the directors so far have been from business education and have been former students of mine, graduate students. Mm-hmm. I hope it's not just because they were, but because of their qualifications and abilities. I might add that the area or the areas that have had most representation in leadership roles in vocational education have come from industrial education or ag education, and have Wisconsin with well since 1964 I guess when they first, so it's been all these years with someone from the field of business education ahead of the program. I think speaks well for maybe some of the work that we've done here in the state.
Mm-hmm. One point of clarification. You helped lobby for the passage of this Vocational Education Act. Is that correct?
I don't think that's quite correct. I was on a committee that really went to what was the man's name? You have it listed here. Perkins, Congressman Perkins, that's right, Congressman Perkins. But Paul Lomax and Ham Fortner and I were the three people. Paul was a professor at University New York University, and Ham Fortner was at Columbia University, and I from Wisconsin were appointed, and Hollis Guy was the executive secretary of the National Business Education Association at the time. So we went to Congressman Perkins' office by prior arrangement, appointment, and talked to him about this. And our actually the bill had been passed. Well, I should say all the committee work had been done. It was ready to go officially for approval when we entered the scene, and we made the appeal that we needed business education to be expressly stated in the bill, otherwise it would be left up to interpretation. And Perkins called in his legal counsel and said, is there any reason why we cannot change the wording to include business education since it's intended? And the legal counsel indicated there would be, he saw no reason why. And so as a result of that conference, of that contact, the word business education was added. Mm-hmm. So it's just, I don't, maybe you can call that lobbying, but it wasn't in the sense that we went before a committee, and we just went before the mm-hmm. committee chairman and his legal aides. But we think it had tremendous influence. It might have someday down the road. You know, just to prove the point, after the law was passed and became operative, I would go to meetings and I would hear someone say, this new vocational field of business education. Now it was new because it was newly supported, but business education is the oldest vocational field there is, mm-hmm. starting with the private business schools back in the 1850s. And it had always had a vocational objective, but the point, some felt that unless it was supported by the federal government, it wasn't vocational education. Well, I would always challenge that point of view. But certainly, monies have been made. I heard just last night, Proxmire was talking about the tremendous increase in the amount of federal aid to education, the tremendous increase in the amount of money spent on education today, yet each year for the last 15 years the achievement levels of students by all the tests taken have decreased rather than increased. So I don't know how much good all this federal funds have done really, but it's an interesting story.
Okay, I think the last thing I like to ask you about is more of an impressionistic nature, and that is concerning various things. For instance, the nature of the student body that you've seen during the years. I've asked this question of everyone I've interviewed so far. How do you analyze changes in the student body and that sort of thing? What is your impression over time?
Well, I really don't know how to respond to that. I first started teaching in 1927, and obviously students were different as I met them in my classes in those days than they are now, but the difficulty is it's so gradual that you hardly perceive it. The factor of television and increased means of communication and all these things have made their contribution. But I'm not one, I guess I'm not one that feels that that people today are so basically different than they have ever been. And I have said throughout my professional life that kids respond pretty much the same today as they always have. I think obviously there's more independence, and during this period particularly of the riots and protest groups and so forth, certainly during that period. But I think we've come way back from that, and I'm teaching a class right now at the University of Whitewater, 3 mornings a week, just for on a volunteer basis and doing it for fun. And I have a class of 22 or 3 students, but I wouldn't get up on a bandstand and want to orate on how kids are different today. I just don't feel so strongly about that I could make a strong position. Mm-hmm. So I guess I kind of strike out on that.
No, that's how, because that's, that seems to be different from what other people said in some respects. Most people, I think, are, so far, seem to be fairly similar along that line, but they're with differences.
I think that I might say that young faculty coming aboard, I think there's a great difference there than they were formerly. I think the system has contributed to that a great deal. Young faculty today are more concerned about doing the things necessary, and the system has caused this so they can get their tenure established. And so...
Do you think there's more of a concern among faculty than to gain tenure now than there was when you were coming in?
Well, I think the criteria are more, the criteria are the same, but I think the evaluation of those criteria are so much more stringent than they were in the earlier days, and that people are doing those things, instead of letting that come naturally with actual work, are pointing their work towards that which may not be meeting the needs of the professor who should be teaching classes. And I think there is a conflict there with the emphasis on the younger faculty to be less concerned with the teaching and more concerned with the research, which will get them the tenure more quickly than success in the classroom. And I think our system has caused this to develop and evolve.
Would you say that faculty now are less concerned with teaching, at least initially, than they were when you were?
I feel this very strongly. I have that very strong impression. Now, of course, I have been away from it the last 2 years, but certainly, as I observe and my last few years at the university, you see, it's an entirely different ball game. Up until recent years, there were no monies for research, and so today, by getting research funds and being able to carry on research that you can publish and get paid for it as it be your salary, you see, this is a possibility, but it didn't exist until 1960, for example, mm-hmm. and then it's been increased a great deal in the last mid-60s, I would say, on. So today, the faculty member that can get a research grant and devote X percent of his time on the research grant that would lead to publications and hopefully some significant contribution to the profession is a shorter way getting tenure than going to doing becoming an most outstanding teacher possible who isn't doing the research, you see. And to do the research as a part of your load makes things more feasible than if you have to do it in addition to a teaching load. And, mm-hmm. and it's that factor that I was referring to.
This Joan Roberts case came up, in fact, just resolved recently. And one of the things that, of course, was at issue there was a matter of sex discrimination, this hiring of faculty and that sort of thing. And as you mentioned, the School of Education faculty, when you were chairman, outside of the Women's Physical Education Department, was almost 100% male. And even though it's well known that most people in the profession as a whole, down into lower ranks, so to say, were female. Can you comment on that? Or?
Yeah, this is one of the interesting commentaries on higher education, and I often thought about in elementary education, particularly 95% of the teachers were females, women. And yet at the University of Wisconsin, for many years, we had not a single woman. Occasionally, there have been a few. Sarah Rule was one, two or three others. A lady by the name of Larson was here. But and there was never any attempt to include women. When you had a vacancy and you invite nominations, women didn't have the terminal degrees. They didn't have the requirements to become applicants. And so we would want women, and we have always wanted women, but it has only been in recent years that larger numbers of women have completed the terminal degree so that they would become eligible and qualified.
Now, what would you speculate as to the reason why women were not doing that before?
Well, I would speculate that one factor was that they just didn't see their role at that level.
Mm-hmm.
You may say, well, they would see the fact that they're all men and so there wouldn't be that opportunity. But I think it wasn't that so much as they didn't see this. And I think what's happened with the movement in recent years, they now do assume a role there that they just didn't compete for previously.
Mm.
We never in all my experience at the University of Wisconsin did we deny a person to become eligible for a PhD degree because it's a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And if the woman had complete the degree, and when the elementary program was expanding here and you announce a vacancy, you wouldn't have any women because it just weren't women and to any considerable extent who had the degree that would be a minimal requirement for consideration.
Now, would it be a fair generalization for me to say that the women that you did interview and that the women who were on the staff here were by and large single?
Yes, I think that's a correct generalization because it so happens that the first lady that was here, we identified her previously. What was her name?
Was married. Nemec, Mrs. Nemec, was married, but she had been active, and she had been active as an administrator and a county supervisor, I believe, for some years, and had come here with that kind of background and gotten her degree. but Lois Nemec. But I believe Lois is the only, in my experience, the only woman we ever had on our faculty here who was married at the time, or Sally Rue, Larson, two or three others I think of, were all single women. So what that implies, I don't know.
Well, it's a matter of perhaps choices.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
You had to make a choice in the early years
between
being a professor or having a chance of getting married.
Yeah, and raising a family and so forth. Yeah, that choice. That's a good point.
Do you think that that it's put a strain on the faculty, an undue strain or unfair strain on the faculty, through the matter of affirmative action to increase the number of women on the faculty and
other minority groups?
Minority groups as well.
Yeah, I think it did. I think it did and has. I have not been in an administrative position during this period when these drives have come to the front. But my impressions are that, as I talk to faculty, often there's a belief of reverse discrimination and concern that people who previously would have good opportunities for employment are now minimized because of the competition of the other groups. And sometimes where certain quotas have been established, and this has created tremendous personnel problems, in my judgment.
Quotas have been established here, you mean?
Yeah, that you must have. Now, I don't know what has been true, what is true right now, but I understand 2-3 years ago, certain HEW requirements that you had to employ certain number of minority groups, regardless of you just had to employ that number of people, and this meant giving preference to minority groups who might not have the qualifications of other people that you deny that opportunity. So this, I think, now I can't speak with authority to this because I'm not next to it at the present time, but these are some impressions I have.
Mm-hmm. One last thing. There was a book written a number of years ago about the time that the school of education reorganized called The Miseducation of American Teachers.
The what?
The Miseducation of American Teachers by James Kerner.
Oh, yes.
And one of the schools that he looked into in detail was the University of Wisconsin, and actually had fairly favorable things to say about it in comparison to other schools of education. But he did say, nonetheless, that he criticized schools of education at the time for not having enough liberal training and having poor coursework and boring and so on and so forth. Just about every remonstrance that you can imagine. What would your rationale be to that at the time, and then perhaps analyze that in terms of it has
well,
it changed?
Well, certainly that? In teacher preparation, University of Wisconsin, from going back to the early days, there has been an